Hello, I'm Jacob Davis, and welcome to Critics Talk. I'm here with co-founder and artistic director of the House Theater of Chicago, Nathan Allen, and we're going to be talking about a few shows that they have running currently. So, Nathan, why don't you say hello so people recognize your voice?
Hello, it's Nathan Allen.
And what we're here to talk about today are Death and Harry Houdini and The Last Defender, both of which are currently running at the Chopin Theater at 1543 West Division. So, Harry Houdini was, I think, the very first show that the House ever did, wasn't it?
That's right. Yep. In 2001, we opened October 31st, 2001, which was sort of the first public performance by anything known as the House Theater of Chicago, and also the 75th anniversary of Harry Houdini's death. It was his 75th death day.
All right, so that was the significance of the show. And by now, a lot of people have probably seen it because I think this is the fourth revival in Chicago. Am I correct?
Something like that. Close, yeah, if not more. I'm not sure how we count anymore. But
and since this show is so closely tied to the House, why don't you tell us a little bit about how it has changed over the course of your company's existence or how the culture surrounding the show has changed?
Yeah. Well, that's a great topic. So, as a bunch of kids moving here in 2001, like many young groups of friends who start theater companies, I think we had an idea of what we wanted, our audience to look like, who we wanted to serve, and how our work would be different, and we probably had a chip on our shoulder about how we were going to change, you know, the what was.
Oh, where did you come from, by the way?
A bunch of us met each other at least at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. Then there was, in the early days, Carolyn Defrin, who plays Bess now, was the only local we knew. She went to Northwestern. There was just 10 of us then, mostly out of SMU, and then a couple others from around. But so we assembled Death and Harry Houdini as a way to experiment with style, and we were trying to figure out who we were as a group and what kinds of things we would make together. And so we had a sense of all the kinds of tricks and fun and the languages of storytelling that we wanted to explore. And so that first production was very raw and had as every ingredient we could think of in it, and I think dealt more specifically with the stagecraft and the storytelling interests of the group than it did, or at least as that project was as much about figuring that out as it was about Houdini's life or a story about Houdini fighting death and what that might mean.
But in order to do a story about Houdini and to show all these tricks, you have to have a Houdini.
Yeah, so Dennis was in the company then. He and I met at SMU. We were on the same scholarship there, actually. And so I had met Dennis and his magic skills and known about his interest there and capacities there for a few years before we did Houdini, and so we wanted to do the water torture cell in that very first production, but we didn't. We couldn't get one. For one, we couldn't get one, and two, the theater told us they wouldn't let a bunch of 22-year-olds put, you know, a 5,000-gallon tank of water or whatever it was on their stage, which is not completely understandable at the time. And then so Houdini did pretty well. We had a little reader review and a New City Pick of the Week, and we sold 100 tickets a night almost on those two little reviews. Then our next show was a show called The Terrible Tragedy of Peter Pan, and that sort of blew up. The major papers discovered us, and that show ran for about 5 months. Something like 10,000 people saw that show. It was a big hit for us. It was sort of marked our arrival on the scene as a member of the Chicago theater family tree. And so after closing that show, we decided we should go back to Houdini again, as it was something that many of our newfound acquaintances as audience had heard about us doing, but had not seen, because most of them discovered us with Peter Pan. So we brought that back, and we had a little more resource and a little more experience to tweak it, and that is when we actually got the water torture cell and started dealing with rigging, and Dennis began cultivating his effort on that particular illusion. It was still a very different show than the mm-hmm. thing that we would come to in 2012, but it marked a slight shift in focus for the project, and I think then for the company, in mm-hmm. that it wasn't only about the aesthetics involved. We were mm-hmm. really wrestling with, what is this for? What does our theater do? What is our mission? And how do we lever these aesthetics mm-hmm. aesthetics in service of something maybe ethical?
So that's about the time that you started to get a firmer idea about how to connect your sense of aesthetics with storytelling. But I think that is pretty significant about the house is your sense of aesthetics probably is the thing that I still associate you with
sure,
the most. Even
yeah.
the graphic designs on your programs mm-hmm. and your posters mm-hmm. always stand out very strongly.
Well, it's vitally important to us, because the language you speak determines, most of who can hear you, mm-hmm. Or who can understand you when you're speaking. So it's important we think about design and the brand of the company and how we communicate about our work as a language that we want to be heard by a diverse body of people, frankly more diverse than is typically thought to attend the theater. So those that play in those vocabularies has always remained important, and I think has grown. I hope I think we're much more sophisticated now than we were when we started. But in tandem with that, the effort on story. So we often talk in our work internally about separating story and stagecraft mm-hmm. as the elements of storytelling. That the actual craft of story and writing and creating characters that you can identify with that then go on some journey. We embrace a lot of Joseph Campbell thinking in that regard, and so in 2003, I think we saw at least a pivot to point ourselves in the direction of being aimed at story, and then we would spend the next 10 years of the company mm-hmm. really focused, I think, primarily on what's the story, on becoming better the story aspect of story and stagecraft. So that results in then the most recent iteration of Houdini, which I would say is the 2012 mm-hmm. redesign production. That's a completely new design and a mostly new script, revolving around the same characters and the same effort mm-hmm. that had always been present, but had evolved considerably to be the sort of portrait of an artist that the project remains in 2016.
Well, on the subject of the writing process, you are also one of the house's most frequent writers of original shows, because I think almost everything that you do is either original or a remounting of your own shows.
Yeah, is that true? All original. So mm-hmm. even remounts are our own, mm-hmm. IPs or something, I guess. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what you said earlier, something about playing around with Joseph Campbell, and I think mm-hmm. one of the most obvious examples of that was The Hammer Trinity, which
sure.
you did last year, but also remounted in Miami not too long ago.
Sure. I think that mm-hmm. project, The Hammer Trinity, really marked the sort of culmination point of that, of the project of story that mm-hmm. I'm talking about around the company, for me at least. If 2003 Houdini marked the sort of pivot toward that investigation, then we enter something some people might remember as the Valentine Trilogy, which was our first sort of real mm-hmm. investigation into Joseph Campbell and story itself and how to construct such that work in our theater. And then in my own project, artistic project, that work sort of culminates then in the Hammer Trinity, which, mm-hmm. It's been a real ambitious, amazing project, and really just a blast of lots of wonderful people involved.
Certainly ambitious, spread over several years. I believe the debuts of the three parts were, and also it was very meta. It subverted a huge amount of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey.
Sure, sure. I don't know if you can subvert it, but it's...
Well,
we acknowledge it.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's a character who's deliberately trying to replicate it.
Yeah, right.
And you're based out of Wicker Park now, mm-hmm. but the Hammer Trinity also went to Miami.
Right.
Do you think that... I'll ask about Miami next, but do you think that being in Wicker Park has also been an influence on the kind of work you do, and certainly on the kind of audience you develop?
I'm certain it does, but, you know, we haven't been anywhere else since 2008. We mm-hmm. were at the Viaduct, which seemed very similar in spirit to the Chopin, mm-hmm. and Viaduct is now the Constellation. You know, that space, the Viaduct space, determined, that architecture determined so much of our early conversation about ethics, about what we were trying to serve our audience. What is the service of theater, and how does it work? That architecture really supported that. So I think, you know, a lot of our identity was forged actually at the Viaduct, which mm-hmm. is Roscoe Village, but. And then now in Wicker Park, I think it's probably a great location for us in that we're accessible from the highway, and so we're able to pull...
And the Blue Line.
And the Blue Line, but we're able to pull a significant suburban audience for our mm-hmm. more popular stuff like Nutcracker that comes back every year. We get families coming mm-hmm. from all over the Chicago area coming back to that every year, and then a show like Houdini that has, you know, like a tourist effort and a wider audience that Wicker Park is located well for that. Also, Wicker Park is still cool, so it suits us pretty well because we want to be cool. Who doesn't want to be cool?
Sure. Now, when you're in Miami, you're at the Adrian Arsht Center. Is that correct?
That's right.
Uh-huh. Right, at 1300 Biscayne Boulevard in Miami.
That's true.
Is that a different experience? Performing for Miami audience.
Oh, all together, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's wonderful. So we have a residency where we take a show to the Arsht Center annually for the last 7 years. I think that's true, 6 or 7 years. And I feel like we've developed a sort of the house theater of Miami a little bit as well, mm-hmm. and getting to know patrons there who come and see us every year that we're there, and getting to meet them and play with them. But at large, Chicago is a pretty sophisticated theater going mm-hmm. town, and Miami is a very young, culturally a very young city, which is mm-hmm. thrilling to be a part of the, mm-hmm. the cultural service in that town, because there's so many different populations and cultures mixing in that city and wrestling with its own identity and culture, and there's a very different, it's palpable spirit about mm-hmm. going out and participating in arts and culture. So yeah, it's noticeably a little bit wilder, I think, in Miami than it is in Chicago.
Do you think that's maybe the proof of your success with working with archetypes that have broad appeal?
Yeah, I think that, like, the house intends to be accessible, universally accessible. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a lofty goal, and we certainly don't reach it. But our aim is to get as many different kinds of people into the same room as we can, laughing and crying at all the same stuff. And then, on top of that, seeing each other while they do it. So the hope is that there is an appeal to many different types of people or different neighborhoods mm-hmm. in Chicago, like the being a part of that service where Chicagoans can come together and see each other and sit in a space where they can, well, as Aristotle defined it, as catharsis, mm-hmm. where we laugh and cry, but in front of each other. That's a pretty important project and an important service that mm-hmm. arts and culture provides.
Now, you've talked a lot about how these are shows that you and other people involved with the house have written, but this past season you also did two projects that I think were written by their directors and pitched to you by them. Is that correct?
Well, The Revel was written by Damien Kiley and then directed by Leslie Danzig.
Okay.
Bugs Bunny Danzig. Mm-hmm. But Vanessa Stalling brought United Flight 232 about a year and a half or 2 years ago. To me, we've been friends. Mm-hmm. She's been a friend of the. She was in the original Nutcracker that went to that played at Steppenwolf upstairs, and has been a friend of the company for a long time. And so we've been excited about her and her work. And so she brought that project, and we connected then with Lawrence Gonzalez, who wrote the book. He mm-hmm. lives in Evanston, and we're able to piece together that project too. Yeah, so it's been fun recently, especially with our we have a partnership with University of Chicago. Building a lab for new work and experiments in story and stagecraft. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to pull lots of the artists we admire from Chicago mm-hmm. into a space where we can all sort of play together, and the house begins to take on a sort of a curatorial mm-hmm. ability to support mm-hmm. the work of the art and the artists that we admire.
Right, so these particular people didn't just come out of nowhere and say, hey, I have a project I want to do.
No, yeah, that's never happened. You didn't. We're pretty, you know, we pride ourselves on being as inclusive in the work and in our company body as possible. Mm-hmm. But I think that the number one rule for making mm-hmm. great work in the theater is for working with people you mm-hmm. know and love, and great people, and cultivating those relationships.
Do you involve yourself a lot with trying to make those into whatever defines a house show?
Yeah, absolutely. There are rules. Mm-hmm. There are that conversation about aesthetics and ethics mm-hmm. Has resulted in a few. Well, we don't call them rules; we call them guidelines. in order to spark conversation about what makes a house show, mm-hmm. 150 seats, no more than 5 rows, no proscenium. Those all sound like scenic mm-hmm. Guidelines for scenic designers, but they are delivered to everybody on the project because explaining them sort of helps artists come to the core of what we define as the service. 150 seats is a very different experience than 5,000 seats. It's just it's a different social engagement that's floating right around something called Dunbar's number, which Malcolm Gladwell even writes about. Dunbar was a sociologist who studied how across cultures and throughout history, the military unit known as the companies hovered around 150 no matter what. For centuries this has been the case because in theory, his theory, it's like 100, something like 120 to 220 or something is Dunbar's number, but 150 is the shorthand for it. Because at 150, those soldiers would fight and die for each other, mm-hmm. and then in theory at 151, they need a good reason. Mm-hmm. So I notice when I go see, when I'm in a big Broadway house or Broadway mm-hmm. in Chicago house, or even at Steppenwolf or Goodman or any of the larger houses in the city, it's really fun to go and feel like, oh, there's so many people here. This is mm-hmm. so exciting. There's an energy about that. When I go into a storefront experience with around 150 seats or really 200 seats or less, I feel like I can see everybody, and there's a different art form at work mm-hmm. there. So we try and we say 150 seats is the limit in order to focus on the social aspect of going to the theater and trying mm-hmm. to scaffold the experience for the audience. No more than 5 rows, because just pretty much anecdotally, but at the 6th row you start to have a different relationship with the mm-hmm. actor on the stage in front of you. It's harder to see stuff, mm-hmm. harder to translate emotions in the same way. And then, most importantly, no prosceniums. It's very important to us that the audience be able to see other audience members in their experience of the storytelling, so that they can, for instance, in Houdini is mm-hmm. the easiest example, where you're in a traverse, or some people call it an alley, where you're looking through the action and can see audience opposite you. And so when Dennis walks on glass or gets in the tank or does anything amazing, you're seeing other faces, like, you know, with their jaws dropping, and you're experiencing this complicity with your fellow audience
right.
members.
Right.
And that is the sort of Aristotelian ideal in the Poetics that is described.
Something that's interesting about that show is that it seems Houdini's tricks become steadily more morbid
yes.
as the show
yes.
progresses, and then mm-hmm. you can see when he's doing card tricks, everybody gets involved with that and it's fun. And then mm-hmm. later he pulls razors out of his mouth.
Yeah, everybody
cringes. But I'm glad that you mentioned that thing about seating banks, because United Flight 232 was a show where that was very obvious, but scenically it felt unusually subdued for a house show, and yet it was clearly, very clearly one of yours.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose
mm-hmm.
that's the reason why.
Yeah. Well, that's the conversation. So John Musial did that set. Gorgeous set. We're always excited, actually, and 232 was the first in a while. Actually, I think the Revel pulled it off, too, but where a designer is able to come play in our sandbox and we talk about mm-hmm. the rules and they solve them in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt like walking into 232 felt obviously like a house show, but mm-hmm. also different. Also like, oh, we've never quite done this before. Mm-hmm. We've never engaged in the audience and scaffolded the audience's engagement with itself and each other mm-hmm. in this particular arrangement or by this particular means. That is always fun when that pops off. And then, 232 was a different project on a couple different levels for us, just in that it's a true story. It's not mm-hmm. it's not a mythology or a mythologized fable or something. Mm-hmm. It's actually happened.
Well, speaking of the Revel, music is also a very important element
in a lot
of house shows. Well, obviously in that one because it's integral to the plot.
Right.
But you brought in the Old Town School of Folk Music Consultants mm-hmm.
uh-huh.
for the Revel.
We've always had lots of friends there. Maria mm-hmm. McCullough is a company member here and taught, was like head of fiddle, I think. I'm not sure what the correct title is, but mm-hmm. Taught at Old Town School, and we've always had a really good connection with that organization. And then having their partnership in through Jess about music on the Revel and stuff was really fun and totally natural for us. They're one mm-hmm. of our favorite organizations. I mean, they're doing a similar thing with music that we're trying to do with theater. I mean, we share a little bit of that sort of purpose.
Mm-hmm. Now, not all of the shows that you do are quite such traditional theater. Right now, you have something going on in the basement of the Chopin called The Last Defender,
right.
which is different.
A wild bit of nonsense that just won't quit.
It's an escape room.
That's not. I don't know if we would call it an escape room. You could walk out anytime you wanted to, but
it's a puzzle.
Yeah, it's a. We call it a game. We think it's a game. Certainly, there are puzzles in it, but it's been a pretty fun experiment, and for me, sort of reaching, as I was saying, like a culminating moment with. In my own sense of my artistic project with the Hammer Trinity,
mm-hmm.
I'm interested in what's next for me mm-hmm. as an investigation. Not that I won't return to the Campbell stuff, but I'm just hungry for something mm-hmm. kind of different. And Peter Sagal is on our board, who does Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And he introduced me to Max Temkin, who is one of the creators of Cards Against Humanity. And so I got to meet all these great Chicago game designers and foremost Sandy Weiss, who then the two of us got together with Max and figured out that we could, oh, let's do something really dumb. Let's make this thing.
No, it's not dumb. It's really hard.
It's really hard. I'd like to think that there is a true intelligence there, but it's just astounding that it does so well. People love that thing. And it's such a joy. I'll be frank with you and your listeners. Like, I think I got to opening of that project mm-hmm. feeling really satisfied about the experiment itself and mm-hmm. learning what I had learned, and also thinking, like, yeah, maybe I don't need any more from this. Maybe game isn't the mm-hmm. new thing for me. And then I started watching people play, and it's such a joy. It's so fun to watch the strangers go in this room and then yell and scream and run around and then come out, and they're high-fiving and hugging each other at the end of every show. That's like, that serves the mission. That's working.
Yeah,
there's something about that that's really working.
And usually they blew up Chicago.
Usually they have all, you know, narratively at least, they come out bearing some blame for the deaths of millions, but... It's
it was fun.
Never been more fun.
You do special events with Peter Sagal from time to time.
Yeah, that's right. He's hosted our benefits and things. He's a good friend.
Mm-hmm. And something that I admire about the house is that you do clearly have a very strong sense of community with each other. Mm-hmm. My first exposure to you was at the opening of the Complete Hammer Trinity, and great. I know that day is probably burned forever into your mind.
Oh, yeah, it was horrible. That was horrible. We had an actor go out with an injury in the 90 minutes into a nine-hour day. And my partner in crime, Chris Matthews, had to go on stage on that day to complete the role, as the understudies naturally had not yet gotten the time. But an understudy, I'm proud to say, Aaron went on the following day. He was ready. It was amazing. But
he was ready with 9 hours. I remember. Actually, Chris was amazingly good.
Yeah, sure. Considering.
You muttering state directions to him.
Pointing on the floor where he should move.
and pick up those things.
Yeah, and go there now. Go now. Faster. Yeah, it was pretty wild.
Even though that was in some ways horrible, it also was proof that you do have a very strong sense of camaraderie with each other.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. Well, I'm proud of that. It's a really, like I said, an incredible group of people who we've found to work together with, and Chicago at large. I think the scene is a pretty terrific place to live and work and explore and learn in the craft, and so there's been no shortage of exciting relationships that we've found with artists who share our ideals.
You recently announced the house's upcoming season. You'll be directing something called Diamond Dogs.
That's right. Yeah, it's awesome. So Steve Pickering and the guys from Shanghai Lo have adapted this sci-fi horror story from Alistair Reynolds, who's created. He's a fairly popular author in the hard sci-fi. The story comes from his Revelation Space, which is a setting far in the future where humans have explored the galaxy and found evidence of alien cultures, but no actual aliens. Mm-hmm. That something in the universe seems to be allowing cultures to achieve a certain moment, and then they are crushed or wiped. So there's this existential sort of dread and horror going on.
Yes,
in the show.
That does sound like something you
would. Yeah, I'm really excited about it. It's going to be really fun.
Well, Nathan Allen, thank you so much for
talking
to me.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jacob.
The House Theater of Chicago performs at the Chopin Theater, 1543 West Division. The Death and Harry Houdini is performing through July 24th. The Last Defender has been extended again through August 7th.
That's right.
I think is the
That's
most
right.
recent
That's
extension.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.